Hey, Mike.
Yes.
Hey, what's up? It's Andy from Gyms for Men.
You're early.
Am I?
Well, you said 3:15. It's like 3:07.
Yeah, I just couldn't wait.
Okay.
I'm out of work. I'm in my car. Ready to talk.
Okay, let's do it.
Did you come straight here from Virginia, or was there anywhere in between that you live?
Well, I lived in San Francisco for a very brief time, probably like 3 or 4 months, before I realized I was completely unprepared to be living anywhere on my own, especially so far from home. And I just looked for whatever excuse seemed good to move back, which came in the form of an invitation to play in a band with Colin Sears and Peter Kortner, who had been in Dag Nasty. And that band turned out to be called Los Vampiros, and it was pretty much just a one-off project. A lot of songs that Peter had sort of stockpiled that he didn't think were exactly right for Dag Nasty, so we recorded an album and we played one show at DC Space, and that was that.
Well, you've really played with a lot of great musicians over the years. It seems
I have been
like
and very fortunate in the people who I've come to know and at least jam with, if not actually be in bands with some of those people.
Well, that's a big part of the fun of just being in music,
mm-hmm.
you know, and living a life in music is that, you know, if you're open to it, if you're open to playing with lots of people, you meet a lot of cool people and you meet,
yep.
you know, some very, very talented people.
Indeed.
So taking it back, were you born and raised in Reston?
I was born in the District of Columbia at Washington Hospital Center. We lived in Maryland for, I think, the first 2 or 3 years of my life, none of which I remember. And then we moved to Springfield, and then we moved to Reston in 76. And I lived there for most of my formative years. I would have been 7 years old at the time we moved to Reston. And then I lived there until like 92, something like that. Well, I moved to San Francisco in 91. And then my parents, when I came back, moved to Sterling not long after that. So I lived in Sterling with them for a little while and then moved out on my own, lived in Arlington for a while before eventually moving out to Los Angeles.
So you've spent a lot of time in and around the DMV, basically.
Yeah. And what a treat that was.
What are your memories from being like 7 years old in Reston?
Back then, it felt like it was way out in the country, very isolated. Like, the only thing that seemed like it was around there was Dulles Airport. And at that time, you know, you could just go to the airport and hang out because it was, you know, before all the people started doing bad things with airplanes. They made security much more tighter. But it just felt like there was a lot of trees everywhere. I remember all the trees and all the bike paths. And, I don't know, it just seemed much less urban, even than Springfield, which is not, you know, like a super urban place, but I guess the part of Springfield that we lived in was close to, where, you know, like, the couple of big streets are there. So it felt a little bit busier. So Reston just felt much more tranquil and sort of country-ish.
How did you start playing guitar?
Interesting. I think, you know, when I was young, probably 7, 8, 9, like a lot of people of my generation, I was a huge Kiss fan and I thought, oh, those guys are amazing. Like, I want to be a lead guitar player like Ace Frehley. But in my mind, there was this disconnect of, you know, these guys are these highly trained professionals, and that's, like, so unattainable for me. And so I kind of didn't do anything with it for a while until I stumbled on punk rock when I was, like, 12 or 13. And then the message I was getting was, like, oh, anyone can do this. So I picked up a guitar, and, you know, like, it was a much lower barrier to entry. And things just kind of went from there. I'm still trying to get better as a guitar player today. I've been playing for, I don't know, 35 years now, something like that. 36, 37, I don't know.
What was the first song that you you played, like the first punk rock song you learned?
It was probably something by the Ramones. I think I was listening to Road to Ruin at that time, and those were all, you know, they're all bar chords, and, like, once you learn bar chords, you can kind of figure out pretty much any Ramones song. So I don't remember specifically, but it would have probably been something off of that album.
Were you aware of what was going on in D.C. at the time?
Yeah, I was. And I don't know how I became aware of that. I think, I had some friends who were already a little bit more tuned in. And I kept going to them, you know, like, hey, like, tell me about this. Tell me about that. Like, what's this band like? You know, who are some bands I should be listening to? And my friend would make me compilation tapes. And the first show that I went to was Black Flag on the Damage Tour, which would have been 83, at the old 930 Club on F Street. And when I went down there, I went with a different friend from school on the bus, because none of us drove. And we didn't know how we were getting back when we went down there. But we figured we would figure it out, and we ended up, you know, getting a ride with some older kids from the area, which was nice. But and I didn't have the full appreciation at the time that that was, you know, Henry Rollins' grand return to D.C., his first time back with Black Flag after he had moved away from D.C. to go join Black Flag. So it was kind of a special night. And all I knew was Black Flag was a cool band that I had heard of, so I just wanted to see that.
What was the show like?
Oh, it was amazing. It was just like, it was a huge revelation for me. I had heard, you know, I had heard people talk about what slam dancing was, and it sounded like it was just people fighting each other. But then I got there and saw firsthand, like, oh, it's just kind of like jumping around and sort of pushing each other, and everyone seems to be having a really nice time. And just kind of the whole idea that there was this scene that I kind of was vaguely aware existed, but I had never experienced it until that night, was just this huge eye-opening, like a whole part of the world opened up for me that night that I didn't know existed, and I was totally hooked.
Did you know any other musicians in Reston at the time?
I might have. You know, there was a bunch of us who were, like, fans of punk rock, and none of us really played much, but we all kind of learned instruments together at the same time. And there were a couple of older kids who were, say, like, 3 or so years older than me. And one of them was Steve Niles, who went on to play in Grey Matter. He lived in the same apartment complex as me, so I saw him all the time, and he was kind of a mentor of punk rock for me. So I would go over and hang out with him at his apartment with his mom and talk about music. And he was also, like, super into horror films, and I was into Super 8 filmmaking and stuff, so we talked about that as well. And then Jeremy Bunn, who played briefly in Honor Roll in Richmond, was another one of those sort of, like, older kids who we looked up to and got sort of a lot of our information from those guys.
So how did you go about forming, like, your first band?
So it was me and my best buddy, Dave Allen, who listeners may know, later joined the band, or formed the band, Branch Manager, who had a couple albums on Discord. We just kind of were friends, and we kind of discovered punk rock together, and we both said, like, hey, like, we should be in a band. Like, we don't play any instruments, but we'll figure it out. And I wanted to be a guitar player. He wanted to be a bass player, but at that time he was just kind of like a jack of all trades. He played a little bit of this and a little bit of that, wasn't really great at any of them, didn't specialize in any of them. And he was the singer in Pudwack. He didn't play an instrument in that band. And we just had a couple other friends who sort of, like, played a little bit, and we all just sort of learned together. And then we got together with the one guy we knew who actually played drums and played well, which was Pete Luchter, who went on to play in Gwar a few years later with a lot of other ex-Northern Virginia guys. And he kind of, Pete didn't really want to commit to being in our band. He's sort of like, well, I'll play with you guys for this show, but I'm not in your band. That kind of thing. But it was good enough for us to kind of, like, hear ourselves play and get better. And, you know, we were pretty terrible for a long while, but we kept at it for whatever reason and eventually became semi-competent.
Where were you guys able to play? What were the shows or venues that were available to you at that time?
I think our first performance, and at this time it would have been under some different names because we hadn't come up with the name Pudwack yet. Our first performance was at the Reston Community Center Battle of the Bands in 83, I think. And I remember, I don't know, we didn't play well, but we played, like, okay enough, you know, like, we played the songs the way they were supposed to be, but with, like, no energy or enthusiasm because we were, like, super nervous just to be there. And we kind of felt like we didn't belong because everyone else was, you know, like, a pop band or, like, a heavy metal band or something, and we were just, like, these goofy punk rock kids who, like, everyone teased and looked down on at the time. You know, that's something, like, I don't know, like, people maybe don't have a sense of these days because punk rock is kind of a mainstream thing, but in those days, like, we were all outcasts and everybody, you know, like, made fun of us and beat us up and stuff. And, you know, we were punk rock was definitely not a thing that was accepted like it is kind of today, you know.
Where did you guys come up with the name Pudwack?
I don't know. It kind of came out of nowhere. Dave and I used to spend a lot of time coming up with band names, and it's still a fun pastime because coming up with band names is fun. But I don't know, that one just popped into my head one day, and we both laughed so hard at it. We're like, oh, that's got to be it. You know, because we weren't very good musicians at the time, we kind of relied on humor quite a bit for, you know, the content of our act. So Pudwack was very much sort of a humor-oriented punk band, and I think if we didn't have humor, we would have just been a terrible band.
You guys actually did record a little bit too as Pudwack.
We did.
Right? Where'd you guys do those recording?
So we recorded a cassette release album with a guy named Mike Clayburg, who was at the time playing bass in sort of one of the very first ever sort of metal punk crossover bands, which is called Malefice. And this was in the days where, like, nobody was playing metal except, like, Corrosion of Conformity was kind of, like, one of the first bands to dip their toe in that water, and then DRI. But locally, they were kind of the only ones who I knew who were doing it. And we met them at a Battle of the Bands where they played as well. They were kind of based in Vienna, Fairfax. And he is just like, hey, you guys are good. Like, I have a 4-track. You want to do a recording? And we said, yes. So we went to his house and did it there.
And how did you guys, like, duplicate it and, you know, put together the cover art and that whole thing? Like, what was the process?
Yeah, so... our bass player, Sean Philpotts, designed all the cover art. He's a very talented graphic artist. And we just, you know, you Xeroxed the covers. And the duplication I did by myself in my bedroom with two tape decks, or actually I think it was a double tape deck, and just did them one at a time. And... you know, we Xeroxed some labels and we put those on the cassettes, and we just pretty much sold them at school, at South Lakes High School, and whatever shows we played at. You know, Pudwack played a couple of shows in D.C. and Richmond and so forth before we sort of broke up and then reformed as some other band.
What songs do you remember, or what songs stood out?
Well, our sort of the songs that we were known for were a very noisy punk rock cover of The Bunny Hop and an original song that we called My Brain Hurts.
Who were the songwriters, or like how did you guys go about writing tunes?
I wrote a lot of the music and just kind of came in to practice and said, hey, I have this chord progression. And Dave Allen, who was the singer, wrote almost all the lyrics. A couple of us contributed on a couple of songs when we had music and he didn't have any lyrics for him, so the rest of the band chipped in on some things, but he wrote most of it.
How do you guys wind up on those two compilations that you were on?
So the Mutopia one was DSI Records, who were, I guess one of the very first Northern Virginia sort of underground labels. And the Malaphite guys were in with them, and they introduced us to them. So that's how we ended up getting hooked up on that. And then I think we were also on the WGNS Halloween compilation, and we knew those guys from their band Bloody Mannequin Orchestra, and that's where we met Colin Sears, who was the drummer for Pudwack for a year or so, 84-ish, around there, which is when we recorded that cassette album. And then, of course, he went on to be in Dag Nasty a couple years later.
But you never recorded at the studios?
Not as Pudwack, no. Foundation, which was the band that we morphed into in sort of 85, 86, we recorded at Inner Ear, which is, the studio in Northern Virginia with all the rich history that it has. And then I actually ended up working as an audio engineer at Inner Ear for several years in the mid-90s.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a great time. I made almost no money, but I had the time of my life.
What band do you remember recording while you were at Inner Ear?
Dismemberment Plan. I was able to do a little bit of work on some Discord bands like Fugazi and Slant Six, but mostly Don Santara, who owns the studio, did all that stuff himself. And I would just sort of fill in for him once in a while when he's like, hey, I have to go pick up my daughter or whatever. Can you cover for me for an hour? So I would do stuff like that. But, those bigger known acts would mostly be him, and I would I ran sort of the B studio, which is a smaller room at the time, and so those were more for like up and coming bands who were just kind of looking to get sort of the Inner Ear experience on a smaller budget. There were a lot of cool bands that I worked with. Maybe the Goons sticks out the most to me. They were like an Arlington based band. But a lot of like cool young bands. It was really fun to work with all of those guys there. It was very rare, like maybe once or twice out of all the bands I recorded, when I said, oh my God, these guys are so terrible and I can't stand doing this. Almost everybody was at least, like fun or pleasant to work with, even if they weren't the greatest musicians. And some of them were really, really good. There were some bands that came in, like this band, Boudin, who's, sort of like fusion, punk jazz fusion stuff. And they were so good that I could like not even keep up with what they're doing. They would do these crazy time signatures and stuff, and they would say, oh, I think I was off in this one part. And I would be like, I have no idea, dude. It all sounded good to me. So I think you're all right. I think they all knew each other from some music conservatory in Warrenton.
Do you recall ever recording like any other fans from Reston or from the area that went to South Lakes or anything like that?
Not in my time at Inner Ear. Before that, I was friends with Brian Stewart, and he said, hey, I've got this band called Avail, and we're going to do a demo, and would you, like, come to the studio? And he didn't say, will you produce it, but he just said, will you come to the studio and kind of, like, help us and make sure that it sounds good? So I kind of unofficially produced that demo for them before he ended up leaving the band and being replaced by Tim, who was the singer later on.
Yeah, who had been the drummer in LBK.
That's right.
And, yeah. So, I mean, were you aware of, you know, what took place later on in Reston and the concerts that kind of followed those Battle of the Bands concerts that you had been involved in early on? Like, were you aware of Jam for Man? And,
yeah, for sure. I went to a bunch of those.
So, I mean, do you think of PUDWAC and Foundation in some ways as being like the forebears of that whole scene?
Well, I mean, that's for somebody else to analyze and decide whether we, you know, had an effect on that or not. But we certainly did it first. Whether it made it, you know, any difference as to, like, you know, whether it would have been possible or easier or whatever, is somebody else's decision. But yeah, you know, we certainly did some of that stuff before anyone else was doing it, and I hope that it helped everyone else. I hope that it made it easier for other bands and made it seem appealing for other bands. That would be cool if that was the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys were instrumental in paving the way for those other bands. I know Brian himself was at some of those shows at the community center,
mm-hmm.
and that was influential on him in starting Jam for Man later on.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he would have had the idea for Jam for Man if he hadn't, you know, been to those shows.
Right.
And I don't know that a lot of those bands would have formed if there wasn't, you know, Jam for Man to play at. And if
right.
they hadn't seen a lot of the other bands, you know, being successful and drawing pretty huge crowds at Jam for Man.
Yeah, yeah, it was very well attended.
You know, not every one of those bands was able to transition to playing in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, I think a lot of people felt like the D.C. scene was somewhat close to them.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we used to joke about that back in the days of PUDWAC, that we would pretend that Reston had its own scene, which it most certainly did not at the time. And it was tongue-in-cheek, you know. We're like, oh, we're from the Reston scene and whatever. And we kind of like, yeah, we would go to D.C. all the time, but we would sort of pretend that we were visiting from our own world. But, you know, there was a nugget of truth to that, which was that D.C. has been known to be very insular. And if you kind of weren't already in with the in crowd, it was hard to sort of wedge your way in from outside. And, of course, you know, while we were sort of joking about Reston having its own team in, you know, 83, 84, that turned out to be true not too much later.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And you know, even in the D.C. scene, like you're saying, the D.C. scene is so connected to the Discord label.
Mm-hmm.
And the Discord label's in Virginia.
Well, yeah.
Not even in D.C.
They are in Arlington, technically, yeah.
So, you know, technically they're more Northern Virginia than they are D.C.
True.
So how did PUDWAC evolve into Foundation?
Well, it was kind of pretty much the same guys. You know, it was me and Dave Allen and Sean Philpotts. And Colin Sears had been the drummer in Pudwack, and he left at some point. And we just kind of, we were noodling around, just kind of playing without a drummer in Sean's basement and writing new songs and trying to get away from the humor stuff. And I wouldn't use the word serious because that sounds pretentious, but, you know, less funny songs. And then we met, I guess we already knew Davis White, who was the drummer in Malefice, and he ended up leaving that band, and we called him up and said, hey, do you want to play with us in this thing that we're doing, whatever it is? And so Davis White became the drummer for our band at the time, which didn't have a name. We didn't come up with a name foundation for probably another year or so. We played a few talent shows and battled the bands under different names, just whatever came to us off the top of our heads when we were signing up for the show. And then we came up with Foundation later, which honestly is not the greatest name in the world, but you have to have a name, so that's what it was.
Sure.
But it was still, you know, me and Dave and Sean with a different drummer, basically, and just playing different songs, which were a little bit more mature than the goofy stuff we played in Pudwack.
Well, I find Foundation to be, like, really tuneful, you know, in a lot of ways, like, very, very different from, like, punk rock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and skewing a lot closer to what came to be called alternative.
I suppose that's true. You know, at the time it was sort of thought of as post-punk. And I was listening to a lot of sort of things like Rites of Spring, who had a lot of sort of melodic guitar parts and so forth, and it was more mid-tempoed, and I think but it still had, you know, like kind of like screamy vocals. I think that sort of stuff had a big effect on me when I was writing a lot of that music.
Who were some of the other guitar players that you listened to
back then or since then?
Back then
You know, I was into pretty much all the Discord bands. I was very into Government Issue. They had a lot of, like, sort of, like, metal edge to them, and I dug that. I liked pretty much whatever band Mike Hampton was in, which, you know, he was in Faith, and then he was in Embrace later. I liked the way he played. Who else? You know, definitely Rites of Spring, Grey Matter. All those guys, and then a little bit later, it was a band from Boston whose name I am blanking on, Moving Targets, who I really liked, and Husker Du back then. So a lot of that melodic sort of stuff came from listening to Husker Du, which would have been at that time like Zen Arcade, New Day Rising, Flip Your.
What was the difference in terms of what you were able to do and able to accomplish as Foundation as opposed to Pudwack?
Well, I mean, for one thing, we did a tour as a Foundation. It wasn't a big tour, but it was getting out of our little area, and we went and played up the coast, you know, from D.C. northward and then into the Midwest. I think as far west as Racine, Wisconsin was the furthest away we got. Coincidentally, I think the best show on that tour with the best sort of fan reaction. I kind of got the impression that it was another sort of suburban scene, kind of outside of the city. You know, Racine is like an hour outside of Chicago, and like where we came from in Reston, the kids there were kind of like just excited to have something going on of their own that wasn't part of that other city's scene. You know, they weren't part of the Chicago scene. They were doing their own thing. And I think that was really cool. And that was the one time, you know, we were not a particularly well-known band, but that was the one time out of all the shows on that tour when someone came up to me and said, hey, I came here to see you guys because I heard you on whatever the local college radio station was. Most of the shows we played, you know, nobody had heard of us. We were just one of the opening acts, you know.
So, did you ever get to hear yourselves on the radio?
Well, outside of a radio interview we did in Boston on the Emerson College station, not really. It's not like we were just turning the radio on and like, hey, there's our band. Like, that would never happen. But, you know, obviously when we did the interview, the guy was like, okay, now I'm going to play a song of these guys. So that was still pretty cool. But, you know, I don't think I've ever just been listening to the radio and heard myself in any band, although people I know have said that they have heard me on in other bands, which is cool, but I've never experienced it myself.
What song did he spin?
Oh, man, I don't remember. It would have been something off of our first album, which is what we were touring to promote at the time.
And what were the songs that the kids in the suburbs were connecting to the most?
That's a great question. I don't remember if I interrogated them about the individual songs. I was just so excited that someone knew who we were and actually came to see us on purpose.
Well, what did you think was working, or what were you able to realize in terms of recording that you think represented the band really well at that time?
You know, I had been really sort of like tearing records apart and in my head, you know, like trying to figure out how they were made. I really kind of got obsessed with figuring out recording and production, which is how I ended up working at Inner Ear, you know, a few years later. I think when we recorded that Foundation album, Don saw this sort of spark in me and how I was like really interested in trying to figure out how everything worked and to make it sound just the way I wanted it. I think he remembered that and years later said, you know, this is a guy I want to work with if I have an opportunity. And that's why he invited me to come work there. But it was really just an obsession of mine to try and get the sounds that I had in my head onto tape. And I think, you know, that's something that I don't know you ever get perfect. You just keep getting better at it. But I think it was evident in that first Foundation album that we were doing something a little bit, I don't know, more mature in terms of production, which is not to say that, you know, there was anything wrong with any other punk rock albums that were produced less. I think, you know, that was kind of the appeal of punk rock for a lot of people, is that it's just kind of raw, bare bones, like you set up and play and that's that. But we wanted to do something a little bit more elaborate with more interplay between overdubs and stuff like that. And, you know, there was a few songs on that Foundation album where I had a guitar that just did melodic feedback in the background here and there. And like, it, you don't even notice it a lot of the time, but I just thought it would be an interesting layer to put on top of things. So I guess to answer your question, you know, we were just kind of doing something a little bit more nuanced isn't the right word. I guess layered, just a little bit more involved in the studio than just setting up instruments and playing.
And was it, was there a difference between the two albums in terms of your approach to recording?
I don't think there was a huge difference, although, like, from a technological standpoint, Don and Eli Janney, who was working at Inner Ear at the time, sort of sold us on this idea that we could free up a bunch of tracks for overdubs if we used MIDI drums, and you know, we could sort of record all the triggers from the live drummer onto the computer, and then when we play them back, we would play samples. And I think that was an interesting experiment, which, you know, you could pull that off for sure these days because that technology is a lot more mature. At the time, it sounded a little weird and gimmicky, and they didn't really sound convincingly like real drums, but we did it because we wanted to free up more track space, and they, you know, they had a 16-track recorder at the time, and we figured we needed those. And now they have, you know, 24, and with the digital, you can do pretty much as many tracks as your hardware will allow before the memory all bogs down. So that's not even a concern anymore, but that was why we did it. But in otherwise, like, I think our approach was fairly coming from the same place, which was we wanted to just kind of put a bunch of different sounds on there. And we had ideas for what things should sound like. I don't know necessarily if the second album was as successful in terms of us achieving what we envisioned it to be, but I don't think we approached it much differently.
And did you guys score to support that album too?
Not as such. You know, we played a bunch of sort of regional shows, you know, as a lot of bands from the area do, you know, played Richmond and, you know, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, you know, like just kind of up and down the mid-Atlantic, but we didn't really do another tour.
Well, then what happened to Foundation?
We kind of fizzled out. I couldn't point to any one reason why we decided that, you know, we just kind of weren't going anywhere anymore, but that's what we decided. And Davis then was transitioning over to being a full-time lead vocalist in Repercussion. And at that time, Dave Allen had been replaced, actually at the time of the first tour, well, the one and only tour, he had been replaced by Ron Winters, who then, after Foundation, went on to form Branch Manager. Ron was the singer, guitar player in that band. And then, of course, Dave Allen was the bass player in that band. So they all kind of like circled back together. You know, I feel like in our generation, there was just sort of like a handful of Reston musicians who all played together in various incarnations and arrangements, and we all just kind of like switched parts and became a new band, which I don't know if that's true for later generations because I wasn't
involved.
That absolutely
continued.
Yeah, okay.
That's another one of the traditions that you guys must have started.
Well, I don't know.
Laid
we
the
take
foundation,
that.
If you will, for what everybody else did.
I think, you know, you just you play with your friends, the people you know, and it's easy and it's comfortable and it's easier to just like sort of reform a band with one or two different pieces than it is to go meet people you've never known before and never played with before.
I mean, what do you think of the fact that this sort of like family tree of Pudlak spread out to all these like amazing bands?
Oh, what do I think of that? I don't know. I think it's pretty cool. I think that, you know, I knew that those guys were talented, and I think we all got a little bit lucky that we were able to then continue playing with other talented people who brought out the talent in them. You know, I was there when Dag Nasty was first like come up where they first came up with the idea. We were just standing around on the street between bands at Wilson Center. I was talking with Colin and Roger Marbury, who had also been in Bloody Mannequin Orchestra before that, and we're chatting with Brian Baker, and he said, you know, I've got this idea for this band and I think you guys should be in it. And we thought he was just like BSing at the time, but then like they actually went ahead and did it. And it was pretty cool. And, you know, Colin said, hey, like Brian played me some demos of these songs that he's thinking of doing, and they're really interesting. And I listened to them, and I'm like, yeah, that's really good stuff. I think you guys are going to be good. And they were.
Yeah. I mean, that's ridiculous that you were right there at the beginning of it, at the start of it.
Well, and then they didn't have a singer. It was just the three of them for a while. And they said, hey, who is this guy that I see you hanging out with at shows sometimes? He's a black guy. He's bald. He seems really cool. We want to talk to him and see if he wants to be a singer in our band. I'm like, oh, you mean Sean Brown? Yeah, I'll introduce you to him. So I gave him his number, and he said in the book Band in D.C., if you've ever read this, he said, to this day, I still don't know where they got my number. Well, it was me.
Huh. That's funny.
But it's not, it was because they asked about him, you know, so it's not like
I just suggested
him out of the blue.
It's good that it happened. It's good that you had, that you could be of service.
That's right.
So, after Foundation broke up, before Los Vampiros, other than recording, were you involved in playing in any bands during that time?
Not really. It was kind of like a hiatus period for me. I was just kind of noodling around on my own. I mean, I did like guest appearances for friends and stuff on their stuff, but and then we did this album Bloodbaths, which was like a side project of Colin and Charles Bennington, who had also been in Bloody Mannequin Orchestra. And it was really kind of Charles's project more than anything else. The bunch of songs that he wrote. And I played second guitar on that. And I brought Ron in to play bass on it as well. And we played one full album with that lineup. And I had also played like some guest stuff on their previous album. Yeah, so I wasn't doing much else in that period.
And how about ever since then? Like, how about since Los Vampiros?
Shortly after Los Vampiros, I ended up joining a band called Iceboxers, which was a bunch of other Reskin guys who I had known in high school but hadn't really played with them. Well, that's not 100% true. They had a band in high school called the Pathetics, and at some point they wanted to do a show, you know, like a talent show or something, and their guitar player and their bass player were unavailable for it. So Dave Allen filled in on bass and I filled in on guitar. And we did that one-off show. And then a couple of years later, I got in touch with this guy, John Restad, who had been the singer for that band. And he's like, hey, you know, I'm doing a lot of recording and stuff on my own, and I've got this band now. And I said, hey, well, cool. If you ever need a lead guitar player, let me know. And he's like, actually, I think we might. So I just started practicing with them, and that became a thing that I did for the next several years. Iceboxers recorded one full album and a couple of demos, and we had another album sort of like, I'd say half done when we ended up breaking up in 95 or 96, somewhere around there. And we played all up and down the East Coast, a couple shows in the Midwest, and we had some stuff out on college radio across the country. We hired some promotion company to like send out our CDs to all these college radio stations, and we're getting these crazy reports back like, oh, you guys are huge in Anchorage, you know, or like, or Boise or someplace. Like, they really want you to come play here. I'm like, I don't think we're ever coming to play in Anchorage. I'm sorry.
Would have been cool, though.
It would have been. Both literally and figuratively.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Iceboxers was, I mean, you guys had a lot of members of the band.
Yeah, we had two guitars, bass, drums, sax, and keyboards.
And you guys played some pretty like, out there stuff.
Yeah, it was an interesting sound. Everyone in the band came from different musical backgrounds, and it all kind of like blended together into this weird sort of musical melting pot. Yeah, I was the sort of like the punk rock metal guy, and the bass player was into like Frank Zappa and sort of like avant-garde stuff like that. And then, you know, the sax player was all like about old school Motown R&B and that kind of stuff. And we just kind of mashed it all together.
Weird, but that was, you know, 95.
Yep.
That's what people were doing. Reminds me of Mr. Bungle.
Yeah, we were compared to them often. It was, the descriptions people gave us was Devo meets Metallica and Frank Zappa meets the Beatles.
You could do worse than
yeah, for
those
sure.
comparisons.
Exactly.
And I loved Mr. Bungle.
Yeah, they were a lot of fun.
Yeah. So that's cool. You're going to have to, or I will have to either locate copies of that on my own
or if you've got any of the stuff that you can send me, you're going to have to send it my way.
I'd be happy to.
Because I'd love to check out all of that.
Okay, you got it.
Well, so to kind of like wrap up, like looking back, you know, the my show is called Jams for Man. And
yep.
it's ostensibly like a Northern Virginia, you know, DC suburbs, show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's about all of these musicians that came out of this area.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you could, you know, sort of put your spin on it or your analysis to it, what do you think it was about, like, Reston that brought this out in all these people, that brought this musical creativity out? And what do you think it was about kind of the D.C. area that made this, you know, do-it-yourself thing possible?
Well, those are two separate questions in my mind. And, you know, I don't know if I have the answers, but I'll play armchair psychologist and give you sort of my theory about it.
Okay.
I think for the DC scene, it was mostly about a lot of kids who came from relatively privileged backgrounds. You know, a lot of these kids were the sons of senators and congressmen and so forth. And they're taking a look around and going, you know, we don't really like the world that is being built around us, and we have the ability to say something about it, and let's do that, and let's tell people, you know, like, it doesn't have to be this way, and let's kind of do our own thing. And, you know, as far as the do-it-yourself aspect of that, it was really just those guys saying, you know, like, nobody else is interested in doing this for us. So we're going to figure it out for ourselves and just kind of like learn how to press records and learn how to, you know, print the album jackets and so forth. And all of that is fairly well documented. You know, they talk a lot about it in the Salad Days documentary and so forth. And I think it's really fascinating, but it's kind of well-tread territory. As far as Reston and the suburbs go, I would theorize that for a lot of kids, it was kind of boring living out there. Like, there wasn't a lot going on, or at least that was the feeling we had at the time. And so we just kind of, like, decided that we needed something to do. And for whatever reason, we stumbled across music as the thing that we could do rather than, you know, like, some kids were just, you know, like, drink or do drugs or whatever, or just get into trouble, and we're like, hey, this is more fun, and we've got something to show for it when we're done, and, you know, maybe we could make it into something that we, like, do with our lives. I don't think, at least not for me, it wasn't out of any grand plan of, like, I'm going to change the world with my music or anything. It was just sort of, like, a fun thing to do, and, you know, a way to keep busy that wasn't, you know, getting me into trouble.
Well, you changed my life with all the music that you've been a part of.
Oh, well, that's very nice of you to say.
I got to be honest. Like, you know, I had no idea that, you know, you were a part of so many different bands that and projects that I love. Not to mention, you know, like I said, kind of inspiring a lot of the earlier groups in Reston to do what they did.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's if that's my legacy, then that's a pretty nice legacy to live, to leave or live. However you pronounce that.
Well, that's the legacy that, you know, you left for me. So I appreciate that. And that's, you know, that's what I'm trying to document on this show.
Mm-hmm.
So this has just been amazing getting a chance to talk to you about all of it.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thanks, Andy.